From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Our regular contributor Faith Salley recently asked what appeared to be a simple question. What's the difference between rap and hip-hop? Well, I thought rap was the actual, you know, rapping, rhythmic speech. And hip-hop was the music that featured rapping over whatever, beats, samples from other songs. But it turns out that Faith's simple question has a very complex answer, as you'll hear. For one thing, you have bands like The Coup from Oakland who definitely use rap, but are also a live band that plays funk, punk, and psychedelia. So is that hip-hop?
With hip-hop, it was always, to me, the idea was to get all kinds of unusual influences and put them into a certain sort of thing.
That's Boots Riley, the leader of The Coup, and you'll hear their live set coming up later. Also, a look at the biggest 10-year-old in the room, iTunes. But first, speaking of hip-hop, you've probably heard that the new film version of The Great Gatsby by director Baz Luhrmann features a soundtrack put together by rapper and hip-hop mogul Jay-Z. It's full of very modern songs and one or two that are only semi-modern.
Forever, I always need her. She lied, but I believe her. Love sick, I got that fever. Love stupid, I know it. Love stupid, I know it. I know, 'cause I'm a fool in love.
Will.i.am's Bang Bang is new, but you can hear samples of the 1920s song The Charleston running all the way through it. Now, when F. Scott Fitzgerald wrote The Great Gatsby in the mid-20s, he actually had very specific songs in mind. A soundtrack of sorts, and one which the new film has almost completely ignored. Will Friedwald wrote about this recently for the Wall Street Journal. Will, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Hey, it's a pleasure.
You write that Baz Luhrmann and Jay-Z, not to be confused with Jay Gatsby, picked the wrong literary giant to mess with when they saturated the new version of Gatsby with modern music.
Why? And I kind of get the point. I saw the movie. And it's all about, you know, part of Fitzgerald's point was that he was describing a new generation that was doing things that were shocking to the previous generation. Mm-hmm. And the way that Mr. Luhrmann and Mr. Z communicated that was by putting in music that would seem shocking to older people today, I guess, which would be rap and hip hop, even though rap and hip hop have been around for 35 years,
right.
As you know better than anybody. But, you know, he wanted to convey that sense of shock and outrage. And you know, putting in 1920s Dixieland bands might not have done that. But the point remains that Fitzgerald was incredibly specific in the soundtrack to his works. And he's probably the only author I can think of that ever did that, the only novelist that really incorporated, except for, of course, you know, Jack Kerouac, who's writing many years later and has lots of jazz scenes in his books, you know, lots of bebop and things. But the only really great American author who's writing, you know, love stories and romances and all kinds of tales of contemporary life and is putting in specific references to music and is doing it in a way that evokes what movie soundtracks would do many years later. Of course, you know, in Fitzgerald's time, there were no, you know, when he was
right.
writing Gatsby, there were no talking pictures.
Right. So how important was music to the kind of ethos that he creates, not just in Gatsby, but in all of
his
works?
Well, all throughout the works. In fact, Dr. Ruth Pregosi, who's a Fitzgerald scholar, in 1977 put together an article called Fitzgerald and Popular Song, where she started a running list. And at that point, she was able to find about 70. And since then, I've gone back to that list, and I found about 30 more. And Fitzgerald wrote 5 novels and about 170 stories. And so, you know, considering that there's 100 songs or references, and sometimes more than once. It's not just 100 references. It's at least 150 references. The songs are shot through.
Right.
All of Fitzgerald's works. And whenever there's a party scene, he tells you the music that's playing. Whenever a couple is making love on the porch, he tells you what song is playing. When a guy goes into a club, they'll have him humming a song. And like I say, Fitzgerald just doesn't set a scene and say, you know, they made love in a Midtown luxury hotel. He says they went into the Plaza, room 805. And it's very specific, and he's like that with the music. Whenever he makes a reference to a song, he doesn't just make up, you know, the Dingbat Want to Go Home Again Blues, he tells you exactly what the song is. And sometimes he'll say something like the beautiful music of Glenn Miller or the lovely words of Irving Berlin. He's that specific.
Well, in Gatsby, which was written in 1925, he's writing about 1922.
Yes.
And mentions the song 3 O'Clock in the Morning, which was released in 1922.
By the lovely waltz of that year, yes.
The legendary Irish tenor John McCormack. And here is that recording.
It's 3 o'clock in the morning. We've danced the whole night through, and the daylight soon will be dawning. Just one more waltz with you. That man, oh, he's so entrancing, seems to be made for us two. I could just keep right on dancing.
In Gatsby, Fitzgerald writes, at the top of the steps, 3 o'clock in the morning, a neat, sad little waltz of that year was drifting out the open door.
He's so specific.
He's very specific. And now, he is the guy, isn't he, who coined the term the jazz age?
As far as I can't find, yes, he gets credit for it, and I try to, you know, look into that. I don't see any other reference in the literature to the term the jazz age before his 1922 book, Tales of the Jazz Age.
Right.
That named the era.
So would John McCormack, whom we just heard, 1922, he's still famous, but he's, you know, he was a star of the teens.
Well, the other thing is, you know, Fitzgerald is not a musicologist. He's not a critic for Downbeat. When he says the jazz age, he doesn't necessarily distinguish between King Oliver and John McCormack. Obviously, one is jazz and one isn't. Although in the very same book, there's a reference to Daisy Fay dancing to the Beale Street Blues. The jazz age means the energy, the whole era in general. He's not specific to jazz versus pop versus country versus blues. You know, he's not a music critic. He's incorporating it there. The jazz age does incorporate John McCormack, who was phenomenally popular in the 20s. So was Gene Austin.
So Fitzgerald also writes in Gatsby that Klipspringer, the freeloading character, plays the Love Nest,
that's a wonderful reference, because in the Love Nest, they talk about all you need to be happy is each other. You don't need lots of money. All you need to do, you know, there's a lot of songs in the 20s that are about that. You know, forget about your avaricious pursuits. All you really need is someone to make you happy. And lots of songs from the 20s and beyond are like that. And the mood is so contrary to Gatsby's whole thing. Gatsby's whole thing is, I'll make $1 zillion and then I'll get the woman I love. And to have Klipspringer play the Love Nest, and then to have him play Ain't We Got Fun, which says the same thing in highly comedic terms, is how Fitzgerald, sometimes he uses music to support a scene, sometimes he uses music to undercut a scene.
So are we missing something because we're not getting the musical references in these songs that are sprinkled through?
Well, maybe that's Baz Luhrmann's point, that if you were to play The Love Nest now, a 22-year-old would not know what the hell you're talking about. Maybe that's what his point was. But yes, that's definitely something that, you know, anybody reading that book in 1925, when they hear Klipspringer playing Ain't We Got Fun, they knew that was ironic. That was definitely a reference they would not have missed.
Well, here is the song The Love Nest, sung by John Steele.
Many builders there have been since the world began. Palace, cottage, mansion inn, they have built for man. Some small and some were tall, long or wide or low. But the best one of them all, Jack built long ago. Was built in bygone days, yet millions sing its praise. Just a love nest, cozy and warm, like a dove rests down on a farm, a veranda with some sun.
The Love Nest from John Steele, another recording from the early 20s, a song specifically referenced by F. Scott Fitzgerald in his novel The Great Gatsby. We're speaking with Will Friedwald, music writer for The Wall Street Journal and creator of Tales from the Jazz Age, the F. Scott Fitzgerald songbook, premiering June 13th and 14th, and then the 20th and 21st at the Café Carlyle here in New York. And, Will, it's not just songs from Great Gatsby. It's the F. Scott Fitzgerald
right.
song.
We're drawing from, like I say, we have a list of 100 songs that Fitzgerald referenced specifically. And the idea is sort of behind the show. It's sort of somewhere between, you could say it's either a very ambitious cabaret show or a very intimate work of musical theater. It's somewhere in between the two. And the idea was, when you go to cabaret in the, you know, what we call cabaret in the Oak Room, the former Oak Room, 54 Below, or, of course, the Café Carlyle, which is, of course, you know, ground zero for cabaret, traditionally, you know, the format that cabaret performers use is a songbook format. Like, you know, right. you get the Irving Berlin songbook, and then some great artists like K.T. Sullivan or Andrea Markovici will come on and give you factoids from the life of Irving Berlin. But having seen so many of those shows, it occurs to me, you know, what if instead of telling the backstory behind the songs, what if we tell the front story? And
now,
the
what
way
does that
to
mean?
Do, well, the way to do that is, what are the songs telling us? What is the message behind the songs?
And not just songs mentioned by Fitzgerald, but apparently also songs inspired by Fitzgerald.
Well, we have a couple of those, yes. And in some cases, many years later, there's a great, a wonderful song called All the Sad Young Men, which took its title from Fitzgerald's 1926 short story collection, his third. And a great example of a wonderful pop song that Fitzgerald inspired. And it's a title he actually got from Keats, but you know, we associate it with Fitzgerald, of course. Tender is the Night, from the 1962 film of that novel.
Then Tony Bennett with that recording.
Tender is the night, so tender is the night. There's no one in the world except the two of us. Should tomorrow find us disenchanted, we have shared a love that few have known.
That is Tony Bennett, the song Tender is the Night from the 1962 film Tender is the Night, based on the F. Scott Fitzgerald novel
yes.
Tender is the Night.
Supposedly that's being remade at some point. Such a thing is possibly in the works.
There's nothing new under the sun, as they say.
Exactly.
Will Friedwald is with me, music writer for the Wall Street Journal. Even in F. Scott Fitzgerald's earliest novels, I mean, he comes out of the gate spouting song titles.
Well, it was amazing because he, like I say, he predicts this whole, he created the Jazz Age and he named it. And just as it was happening, he was the first writer to document it. This whole thing where, you know, kids of the World War I generation were getting involved, you know, were obsessed with sex and alcohol and jazz. And it was this totally shocking thing. And This Side of Paradise, his first book, chronicles that in detail. And it was controversial. It was revolutionary. It was his most successful book. Even it was right out of the gate, and it's filled with songs.
Including this old Jerome Kern classic.
Which was new at the time. It was from 1917, which is when the story takes place, and the book was only 1920. There's not much of a gap there, you know?
Yeah. So Babes in the Wood, why do you think, what was
there's
the rationale?
There's such a wonderful connection, because a couple of kids are singing this song from a brand new Jerome Kern hit show called Very Good Eddie. And they're singing this love song while Amory and Isabel are trying to, you know, get together. And the contrast between the two is so beautiful. The way the song complements the scene, at the same time contrasts from the scene. I mean, Fitzgerald knew exactly what he was doing. He was only 20 years old when he wrote it.
This is a recent recording.
This is a recent recording from the classic show Very Good Eddie. Well, one of the classic Princess Theater shows by Jerome Kern.
The song is Babes in the Wood.
Little lady, don't be depressed and blue. After all, we're both in the same canoe. Have no fear, can't you see I'm here until our journey is through? Little lady, I will take care of you. Give me your hand here where we stand. We're off to slumberland.
Babes in the Wood, a current song from 1917 by Jerome Kern, current when F. Scott Fitzgerald was writing his early novel, This Side of Paradise. That is part of Wilfried Wald's Tales from the Jazz Age, the F. Scott Fitzgerald songbook, a sort of cabaret theater hybrid that premieres June 13th at Café Carlyle, runs for 2 weekends there, and a fascinating kind of counterpoint to the Baz Luhrmann film edition of The Great Gatsby that's in theaters now. Will, thanks very much for being with
you.
Us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure and a privilege.
This is Soundcheck.
When the babes were lost in the gloomy wood, it's no wonder they were so very good. 14 angels were watching them, so all the storybooks state. Sandman's coming, now it is getting late. Give me your hand, I understand. We're off to slumberland. With you I'll go, although we know angel chorus watching o'er us.
Up next, our contributor Faith Saley gets to the bottom of another musical mystery, and we'll hear some live music from the Oakland, California-based hip-hop group, The Coup. That's coming up on Soundcheck. On Wednesday, May 29th, Soundcheck and Q2 Music are marking the 100th anniversary of Stravinsky's controversial, riot-inducing masterpiece, The Rite of Spring. It's an event we're calling The Rite of Spring Goes Solo. No orchestra, no ballet, just a solo piano performed by Vicky Chow from the Bang on a Can All-Stars. I'll host that, and WNYC's Sarah Fishko will join us. She produced our recent special called Culture Shock 1913. That's The Rite of Spring, now 100 years old, in a solo piano version, May 29th, 7 p.m. For tickets, go to thegreenspace.org. Have you ever heard that old saying, there are no stupid questions? I'm not sure I agree with that statement entirely, but I will say that it can sometimes be hard to admit that you don't know the answer to something. Luckily, our contributor Faith Saley is occasionally willing to do the asking for you when she gets to the bottom of a musical mystery. So today, Faith, what you got for us?
Hey, John. Okay, today's musical mystery is one that I've been wondering about for a while.
The Rap Game. Hip-Hop 101.
For favorite rap hip-hop artist, here are the nominees.
So if you're not a fan of rap music or hip-hop music, then you're probably not going to know what any of this means.
Good hip-hop or good rap versus bad hip-hop or bad rap.
The words rap and hip-hop are often tossed around as if they're interchangeable, right? But is there actually a difference between the two? So first, of course, I decided to hit the books. Here's what Merriam-Webster has to say about it. Hip-hop is defined first as a subculture, especially of inner-city youths, who are typically devotees of rap music, and secondly, as the stylized rhythmic music that commonly accompanies rap. Very intellectual. Okay, rap, on the other hand, is defined by Merriam-Webster as a rhythmic chanting, often in unison, of usually rhymed couplets to a musical accompaniment. I feel like Waldorf and Statler from The Muppets are defining hip-hop and rap for us there. But, okay, it does seem like the two terms have fairly different meanings. But I'm going to get a second opinion on this one. Mark Anthony Neal is a professor of Black popular culture in the Department of African and African-American Studies at Duke University. Hi, Mark.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm fine, thanks. I'm still a little perplexed, so I need your help on this. The dictionary says they're two different things, that rap is just the words or the rhythmic rhymed couplets, if you will, and hip-hop is a culture of which rap is a part. Do you agree with that, and do you use the terms differently?
I do use the terms differently. I think clearly when we talk about hip-hop, we're talking about a larger cultural experience that's made up of five elements, of which rap music is one of those elements. DJing or turntablism is an element. Visual arts, graffiti is an element. Movement, you know, what we would call b-boying and b-girling, break dancing, the way the popular media would describe it in the 1980s, and then knowledge or intellectual production. And so rap music is part of that larger aspect of hip-hop culture, but it's also the part of the culture that is perhaps most visible and most well-known to the average person.
So I want to get this straight. Are all rappers hip-hop artists?
So now you're asking me, Mark. You know, about what I find of value. And to be honest, you know, when we go back and think about conversations in the late 80s and even well through the 90s, you know, this language of hip-hop versus rap was very useful for us to parse what was commercial and what wasn't. You know, what was the serious hip-hop heads kind of rap music and what was pop music. So Will Smith would be rap, you know, and say someone like Nas or KRS-One would have been hip-hop. And so there are many folks who are successful rap stars in 2013 that really don't have a relationship with the larger aspects of hip-hop culture. And I think those folks often get critiqued in that way as not being real hip-hop.
So, Mark, is a distinction between rap and hip-hop sort of commercialism versus culture?
I think absolutely. Something that can be bought and sold in the marketplace and whole, its whole value is its value to the marketplace versus something that is part of a lived experience.
Is Eminem rap or hip-hop or both?
Oh, Eminem is straight-up hip-hop. He has had some success, obviously, on the pop charts, but he also has been someone who has contributed to and is knowledgeable of what we know of as hip-hop culture.
Okay, so you mentioned Will Smith as rap. Why is that rap and not hip-hop?
Because it's just straight commercial. You know, Will Smith never attempted to sell music that we thought of as being hardcore hip-hop. He made a particular choice in terms of who he wanted to sell his music to and what kind of themes he wanted to talk about in his music. And to be honest, it was important. You know, Will Smith, Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince, you know, win the first, you know, Grammy Award for hip-hop. And they were an important act in that they helped really to cross over, you know, hip-hop to this broader audience so that more serious hip-hop artists like a Nas at some point, you know, could sell to a mainstream audience.
You know, parents are the same, no matter time, no place. They don't understand that us kids are going to make some mistakes. So to you other kids all across the land, there's no need to argue. Parents just don't understand.
So if I use these words interchangeably today, I'll say fungibly because you're a professor. Do I sound stupid? Do I sound really white or / uneducated?
Depends on who you're talking to. If you're in a room with African Bambaataa and KRS-One, you probably want to be a little bit more careful. If you're in a room with the average 15-year-old who likes Lil Wayne, they probably won't care.
Well, Mark Anthony Neal, I'm sure I'm not the first person to notice that your initials spell man. And
that was my mother's intent.
Oh, I love it. Okay, well, I will always remember you as the man who cleared this mystery up for me. Thank you. Mark Anthony Neal is a professor of Black popular culture in the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University.
Listen, rap is something you do, hip hop is something you live. The difference is kids nowadays, they got the video. Rappers don't need skills to build, so they don't really know. Hear me, yo.
So, there you have it. I personally feel much smarter and cooler for having had this conversation. Do you have a musical mystery that you'd like me to clear up? If you have a question that you think needs to be answered, please send us an email at soundcheck@wmyc.org.
I'm always freaking when I'm speaking. Inside I'm keeping a statement for policing. I'm down for peacing, but not turn the other cheek in. So this DJ, he gets down, mixing records while they go. Round and round, round we go. 2 years ago, a friend of mine.
That's Faith Saley, contributor to Soundcheck, CBS Sunday Morning, and Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. So what do you think? How do you define rap and hip-hop? Go to soundcheck.org to leave a comment or tweet us at Soundcheck.
But back in the days, I knew rap would never die. Too late, baby, bye, bye.
guy in a body boy head, insane in the membrane. Take the train. M-E-T-H-O-T, Manhattan keeps on making it, Brooklyn keeps on taking it. We keep coming back with more and more hits. Party people, I came through the door, I said it before 2 years ago.
Now, as we just heard, there's not exactly a clear-cut definition of rap and hip-hop. The lines can be blurred. Oakland, California's The Coup stretches the definition of hip-hop even further. The group is led by musician and rapper Boots Riley, but it's also a fierce, full live band that brings elements of funk, psychedelia, and even punk rock to their sound. Their latest album's called Sorry to Bother You. Here's The Coup with a song called Magic Clap, live on Soundcheck.
Come on, kids! Gather round!
The future forever. This is the past here. Martin Navigator Coretta. Like a paparazzi picture when I flash my Beretta. Got scars on my back, truth on my tongue. Had the money in my hand when that alarm got rung. We wanna refine freedom from a long to homeland security. We are the bomb. This here, the meeting for the overthrow. Waiting on the concrete roads to grow. Doing lines that ain't quote about. Counting up all that dough you owe, you ain't supposed to know. It's supposable. We are not disposable. Muscle up, kid, we got blows to throw. To the folks in prison, there'll be no decision. We make the motor move, they show for driven. Right now we can't shine, right like a broken prism. I figured out the fuck, pieces of broke, I'm in the class. Streets that are safe to you. 45 shells that are dancing to the beats. Some are so loud in the cans of the speech. Checks that vanish from link out. Grace get locked in the click dot. Salary cap on the birth certificate. Notarized eyes that birth certificate. Morning prayers for the car to start. A man in a whiskey in a heart to heart. Hoping and track truth flash and run. While agony changing with a magic gun. Poetry shadow from the squirrel of the birth. Break tains in the air. Try to feel for it. I skip. Flash in my eyes like magic slap. We slide back as a magic clap. Come on, do it with me.
That's The Coup, live on Soundcheck with The Magic Clap, which also appears on their new album called Sorry to Bother You. The Coup, led by Boots Riley, who joins me at the microphone. Welcome.
Hey, what's happening?
A lot of dancing here in the studio, which we don't see a whole lot of. Let me introduce the rest of the band. Silky on vocals, Hassan Hurd behind the drums, Kev Choice in a little L-shaped wedge of keyboards over there. Benai Rebel Front on guitar, JJ Jungle playing the five-string bass. So it's hip-hop with a live band. And Boots, you made that decision a long time ago.
Yeah, we've been doing that forever. I mean, ever since our first album, it's been live instruments. But on the older recordings, I would program the drums because I felt like, oh, people don't want to hear the live drum things. Even though we were doing it live, I don't know what that was about. But this album more sounds like our live show has always sounded.
Right. And so what is that? I mean, does it do something to the songwriting process when you're doing it with a live band as opposed to, you know, producing it out of samples and programmed percussion and sequencers?
Hip-hop producers who try to make a beat for me always, it never really works. You know,
why?
They might, because, you know, they're making something different and my ideas are weird and off-center. And so I need to work with musicians so that I can come up with just the exact combination that works right for me.
Right.
To be able to write songs to. So, mm-hmm.
Did I hear a line about a salary cap on a birth certificate in the middle of that song?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Is that
one of those ideas?
That's a pretty old idea. The fact that the people that are in the 1%, most of them were born that way. And, yep. You know, you're born into the working class. Most likely generation after generation is going to be in the working class. And it's this idea that everybody pulls themselves up by their bootstraps is one that's sold to us to tell us that we don't need class struggle. And we do.
So now this is the great subversive genius of the coup. The album's called Sorry to Bother You. You've had more provocative album titles in the past, but, you know, the song's called The Magic Clap. It's got this kind of bright, poppy, you know, beat to it. It's got the big, solid bass. Mm-hmm. And yet it is political music at the same time that it's
political. Well, I think
music.
Everything is political. I mean, even if it's a song about being in love with somebody and that's all you write songs about, then politically you're saying there's all this stuff going on in the world and I don't care. This is all I care about. That's a political statement right there. The album is called Sorry to Bother You because it's the soundtrack to a movie that I wrote that is a dark comedy with magical realism and science fiction based on my time as a telemarketer.
No way.
and so, you know.
You were a telemarketer?
Yeah.
What were you marketing?
Well, everything. Newspapers, encyclopedias.
Did you call me at dinner time the other week?
Yeah, that's the perfect time. And so the whole thing with the album is you don't have to know anything about the movie.
Right.
But you do have to know that we're not really sorry to bother you.
If it's a soundtrack to a film, is it a concept record? Is there some narrative that takes you through the
record? It's a concept record in the sense that they both come from my twisted ideas and takes on how to do things. Mm-hmm. So it's a concept record in that sense. You won't know what the story's about to the movie when you hear, but when you see the movie, you'll see how these things fit in.
And when will we see the movie?
We hope to be filming in spring. It's being produced by this guy, Ted Hope, who produced 21 Grams and The Ice Storm and Happiness and American Splendor and all that. And it's being directed by Alex Rivera, who directed a movie called Sleep Dealer.
We're speaking with Boots Riley and listening to the band, The Coup, performing here in the studio. This song, Strange Arithmetic, it's kind of a story here, right?
Yeah, well, it's I've had a lot of inspirational teachers in my life. I've also had teachers who I felt needed encouragement to teach students about the world the way it is.
All right. Well, let's hear the song. It's another live performance from The Coup here in the Soundcheck studio. The song appears on the new record called Sorry to Bother You. It's called Strange Arithmetic.
History has taught me some strange arithmetic. Using swords, prison bars, and pistol grip. English is the art of bombing towns while assuring that you really only bless the ground. Science is the honorable, useful study where you contort the molecules and then you make that money. In mathematics, kid, children don't get at it, but they count the cause of bullets coming out the automatic. And I'm teacher, my hands up. Please don't make me a victim. Teachers, stand up. You need to tell us how to flip this system. Teacher, my hands up. Please don't make me a doctor, teachers, leader. Need the dollar that I flip this system move. Economics is a symphony of hunger and theft. Mortar shells off in echo of the cash and objects. In geography classes, waters, mountains, and rivers. But they don't ever show the line between the takers and givers. Algebra is that unique occasion in which a school could say that there should be a balanced equation. This statistics is a tool and a complicity to everybody's winning. And you're the only critic and a teacher. My hands up. Just stand up. You need to tell us how to flip this system. Teacher, hands up. Please don't make me a victim. Teacher, stand up. You need to tell us how to flip this system. Social studies is the Goliath to tackle, which turns into a sermon on simplicity of shackles. Physics is a school you own, a science of force. Except for how to get the f*** out the ghetto, of course. Home ec could teach you how to make a few sauces and accept low pay from your Walmart bosses. If your school won't teach you how to fight for what's needed, they're teaching you to go through life and get cheated. And I'm teachers, my hands up. Please don't make me a victim. Stand up. You need to tell us how to flip this system. Teacher, my hands up. Please don't make me a victim. Teachers, stand up. Need to tell us how to flip this system. Back and forth.
That's The Coup, live on Soundcheck with Strange Arithmetic, a song from their new album Sorry to Bother You, but a live performance here in the studio. The band is here with us today. Boots, elsewhere on the record, in addition to the live band, you've got guests like Vernon Reed, the guitarist, the punk duo Japanther, Das Racist, the guys from Queens here in New York. When you were growing up, I mean, were you listening to, you know, funk and hip-hop and punk as well? Because that aesthetic is really in a lot of this music.
Yeah, I don't think I got into punk until I was in my 20s, you know, and that really came from collecting records, you know, like just listening to all sorts of sounds. Of course, I knew, like, The Clash and things like that, but I didn't really know a lot of other things. But I think what happened with hip-hop, it was always, to me, the idea was to get all kinds of unusual influences and put them into a certain sort of thing. It's just, if you have a aesthetic and a drive and a heartbeat and you take these influences and feed them through that, adding some new life into it.
It's funny you mentioned The Clash, because, you know, they too, you know, the music with a message, but you could miss it at first glance because, you know, the beat was so steady and, you know, the music was so accessible.
And I think with most music, people listen to the music first. It takes them years sometimes before they even think about the words that they're even singing along with sometimes, you know. So that's we focus on the music first. There are definitely a lot of politically inclined bands that I don't really want to listen to, and I'm down with them and I like what they sound like, but it's the music and the art has to be first.
Right. Well, the band is The Coup, and Sorry to Bother You is the name of the record. It will be the name of the film. It's The Coup, live with us on Soundcheck. And Boots and the rest of you, thank you so much for playing for us today.
Thank you for having us.
Waiting for this year will be here. It will stop knocking and kick down that door. Loved ones, we on the wire. Hesitation is a drug of choice. This time we on fire. Make the mark on the world, let them hear all your voice. Cause our life on this ball is just a blink of an eye. And ain't no fairy. God, mama, gon' help you. When I woke up this morning, brushed my teeth and spit out the lies. Decided I'm gon' live it.
You can hear another live performance recorded here in the studio by The Coup. The song's called Guillotine, and it's on our website, soundcheck.org. Up next, last week, iTunes passed the 50 billion download mark. That's right, billion with a B. And we will talk with Billboard editor Joe Levy about Apple's media player, which is now 10 years old. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. iTunes, the online music and media store from Apple, is so ubiquitous these days, it's hard to remember a time when we didn't have it. iTunes was a game changer 10 years ago when it first emerged. Now, after a decade, it's looking for new ways to reinvent itself. And over at Billboard Magazine, editor Joe Levy has been considering iTunes' impact on the industry. Joe, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Good to be here.
So, MP3s had been around for many years. There were other MP3 players. How did iTunes and the iPod become this kind of dominant force, not just in the music industry, but in our culture?
Absolutely. And, you know, MP3s had been around for a while, but a convenient, easy, and sexy way of buying them legitimately did not exist. The MP3s that you had were generally the ones that you ripped yourself or perhaps you got them less than legally from a peer as you shared music peer-to-peer across file trading sites. Along comes iTunes with the ability to make it simple, clean, easy, and again, fashionable. Both iTunes and the iPod were these sexy, cool-looking objects. And if you remember MP3s in the day before iTunes, it was kind of dorky. You know, it didn't look good. You were skinning your remember when you had a skin for your MP3, your Winamp player?
Right, Winamp, yes.
Oh, my God. It was like, yeah, I can make it look like whatever I want as long as I want to make it look like a van in the 70s.
Right.
And here comes iTunes, and it's elegant. Mm-hmm. And not only that, it has music from all of the major labels. It avoids all of the stumbles that legitimate music, digital music consumption had up to that point.
So 2003, spring of 2003, we're celebrating 10 years of iTunes. The industry is in free fall. The heads of the major labels are seeing this $40 billion industry tottering, and you know piracy has become rampant. And the question was, how do you compete with free?
Exactly. And the music industry was focused on two things. They were focused on trying to stop people instead of enable them. And they were focused on what was crumbling beneath them.
Mm-hmm.
The second was driving the first, obviously. But I talked to executives in those days, and they were rampantly trying to find not just ways to stop consumers through the RIAA suing them, but to go to the government and get the government to shut down peer-to-peer trading sites for a variety of reasons that aren't worth going into and that actually would have been feasible and possible and would have shocked and terrified all of us. Can you imagine the government getting into our internet lives?
Yeah,
it's bad enough that Google is in our internet lives. Here comes the U.S. government. And instead, they managed to work together, which the labels were not good at doing, with iTunes, and iTunes tricked them.
Steve Jobs tricked them.
Exactly.
So basically he was herding cats.
In essence, I mean, what happened was, here comes Steve Jobs with something that looks great and seems to function great, and the labels are like, yeah, you know what, that sounds okay, because, you know, Apple, it's a tiny little company, 2% of the PC market, let's try it out, see if it works, and if it does, maybe we can get it to work for us.
Mm-hmm.
And they unleashed the beast.
Well, back in spring of 2003, Steve Jobs said this at the iTunes Store introduction.
We think subscriptions are the wrong path. Now, one of the reasons we think this is because people have bought their music for as long as we can remember. We've bought our music on LPs. We've bought our music on cassettes. We've bought our music on CDs. And we think people want to buy their music on the internet by buying downloads, just like they bought LPs, just like they bought cassettes, just like they bought CDs. They're used to buying their music, and they're used to getting a broad set of rights with it. When you own your music, it never goes away. When you own your music, you have a broad set of personal use rights. You can listen to it however you want. So, we decided, since no one else was doing this, that we were going to do it.
Now, there is a great irony there, Joe Levy. Steve Jobs sort of, you know, saying, you want to own your music. But as we've learned, when you do buy music on iTunes, you don't own it.
Well, how do you mean? You didn't at first. It came with digital rights management software that meant that you couldn't do whatever you wanted with it. But you pretty much can now.
Although, you know, there's this whole thing now. What happens when you die to your iTunes library? The fact that in what you're actually buying is a license to that music. And
listen, man, if you can't figure out a way around that, you don't belong on the internet. And if you can't figure out a way around that, then you are the kind of person who took the type on the back of an LP seriously when it said unauthorized copying was a violation of copyright, and you wouldn't tape it for a friend. I don't think that's a big problem. I think the really interesting thing about that Jobs clip is how certain he was and how true it was 10 years ago that subscription was not the way to go. But Jobs was a guy who was certain of things, absolutely certain, until he changed his mind. And he very well might have been changing his mind now, as iTunes does seem to be changing its mind. They need to get into the internet radio business, and the subscription business is a possible model for them.
Yeah.
And remember that he was talking to people who did grow up buying CDs and LPs and cassettes. And you know what? iTunes, as well as the internet, made those people go away.
So now that we have Spotify, Pandora, all of these online streaming services, online radio services as well, is that the competition, not the other MP3 sites, but the...
I think where we're going is away from an ownership model and towards a use model.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that part of the reason we're doing that is because we're going away from the computer to the tablet and to the phone.
Mm-hmm.
Mobile rules.
Right.
And if you give me a choice between having one album on a Walkman or 500 albums on an iPod, I'm going to choose the iPod. Now, if you give me a choice between having 500 albums on my iPod and a million albums on my phone streaming, hey, you know what? I'm in for a million.
Yeah.
And more and more people are heading in this direction. Listen, Spotify is dwarfed by Pandora, and Pandora is dwarfed by iTunes, but they're growing.
Right.
Internet radio is growing, and it's what people
those,
like.
Those little mammals were dwarfed by the dinosaurs whose feet they scurried beneath, but we know who this, inherited the earth.
I did not know we would be learning today. We're getting science in. I like it.
So you think that Steve Jobs, so certain in that clip 10 years ago, right now would have been less certain and would have been sort of sniffing around?
As I say, Jobs famously was absolutely certain about things and very dismissive of things until he changed his mind. You know, when they made the tiny little iPod Nano and it worked on flash drive, that was something that he had dismissed all the way up till then.
Okay.
And, you know, he also used to say 99 cents. Everything in the store costs 99 cents until he finally changed his mind, changed it back, and then changed it again and let the record companies raise the price. Amazingly, those guys would have wanted to charge you $3.49 for a track.
For a single.
For a single, which you cannot imagine in this day and age because that's what they got for CD singles.
Mm-hmm.
It was the executives from Warner Brothers who worked with iTunes who came up, honestly, with a 99-cent price point, and they told us at Billboard when they said that to Jobs, he looked at them like they'd given him a gift.
Yeah.
He ran with it, and it's what made it work.
So that kind of psychology of not getting above the dollar mark, you know, it's just some sense. It's just pennies.
Exactly. All of a sudden you think, hey, you know what? I don't really want to pay for music, but it doesn't even cost a dollar.
Yeah.
I'll push this button and I'll push it and I'll keep pushing it.
Well, that's how you compete with free. you know, is cheap. Cheap and easy.
Cheap and easy. Easy was the thing here. Yeah. It was easy and it was elegant and sexy.
So the 99-cent price point sort of given to Steve Jobs by the folks at Warner, of all places, what other part of the iTunes story 10 years on have we overlooked? What else is in iTunes that we don't think about that, you know, that's really important and has played a pivotal role?
Well, I mean, there's ways it's changed the music industry fundamentally. It unbundled the album mm-hmm. pretty much completely. We're a singles or track-driven culture now, but also the way that he got advantage of the record labels, the way that iTunes and all of that became bigger than the music industry itself, and also the way that it changed Apple from a small force in the technology world to a giant, mm-hmm. a company that had a $6.7 billion, which is a lot, market capitalization 10 years ago and has a $400 billion market capitalization now. It's massive. iTunes was pretty much a loss leader for iPhones, first iPods, then iPhones, now iPads.
Mm-hmm. What about sort of the big question, has iTunes been good for us? Not necessarily for Apple, but for the rest of us.
Well, you know, if you sat and played the top 10 digital songs of all time, you might say, I like Adele, but I don't really know if I want to hear the Black Eyed Peas one more time. I like that Gaultier song, but I don't. What it's done is it's driven this very sensation-driven market.
Mm-hmm.
But big digital songs now are huge. We wonder all the time, do we still have a monoculture? Do we still have something that draws us together? We don't all watch the same TV. We don't all listen to the same radio. Well, apparently we buy the same songs.
Yeah.
And we buy a lot of them.
8.3 million downloads of this song by the Black Eyed Peas.
Tonight's the night. Let's live it up.
Get I know that we'll have a ball if we get down and go out and just lose it all. I feel stressed out, I wanna let it go. Let's go way out, face down, losing all control.
I Got a Feeling is the name of the song from the Black Eyed Peas, the number one digital single of all time. Although Adele sort of snapping at the Black Eyed Peas' heels with Rolling in the Deep. Joe Levy, editor of Billboard magazine. And, you know, all of the top 10 digital sellers are songs that I think most people would recognize, at least by sound. Even
well, of course, but one of the more fascinating...
commercials and stuff.
But the more fascinating thing is that they're all relatively recent. Your top five, I Got a Feeling, Rolling in the Deep, Party Rock Anthem from the great LMFAO,
right.
Somebody That I Used to Know, Gaultier, and Carly Rae Jepsen.
Call
Number
Me Maybe.
Four and five... Mm-hmm. are less than a year old.
Yeah. So these are, you know, this is the answer to the question of, you know, the fragmentation of our culture. There are still things that, you know, that sort of...
Absolutely.
Have insinuated themselves.
Absolutely. And when you stop and wonder about that, is there still a dominant force in culture? Look at iTunes. 500 million registered iTunes users in 150 countries around the world. iTunes... 63 billion pieces of content downloaded from it, 20 billion in the last year.
Mm.
That's an amazing statistic. Does it matter anymore if TV is crumbling? If 20 billion things are coming out of this store into our lives, this is a dominant force in popular culture right now.
So to put that in perspective, that's like three things for every living human being on this planet.
Yeah.
That's pretty extraordinary. So 10 years of iTunes, where do you see them 10 years from now or 5 years from now? Will it be
one thing that iTunes
transformed?
Changed is you know, you had this moment where music seemed to be diminished in importance and it made music ubiquitous. Music is around us everywhere, all over in our lives. I see that increasing.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to get to the point where, as I say, you can get everything you can think of through your phone and you can get it easily and quicker than you can right now. And once that happens, wow.
Joe Levy is the editor of Billboard magazine. We've been talking about iTunes on their 10th anniversary. Joe, good to see you.
Good to be here.
I'm repping on a rise to the top. No Lennon or Zeppelin.
Hey!
All your rockets in the house tonight.
Woo!
Everybody just have a good time.
Yeah!
And we gon' make you lose your mind. Everybody just have a good time.
Let's go!
Party rockets in the house.
A little bit of the third most downloaded song ever, LMFAO's Party Rock Anthem. And that's going to do it for Soundcheck today. Tomorrow at 2 p.m., stop by soundcheck.org to listen in as we stream our recording session with singer, songwriter, and violinist Emily Wells. Emily Wells created a whole series of symphonies with her looped violin playing. Now she's back with a new album called Mama Acoustic Recordings. That's tomorrow, 2 p.m. Eastern, at soundcheck.org. Tomorrow night at 9, Tom Jones. The one and only, the Welsh singer, has a new album out that will surprise his longtime fans. And folk artist Sam Amidon joins us to play songs from his new album called Bright Sunny South. Plus, an unpublished lyric sheet from Bob Dylan is up for auction this summer. We'll hear about the song, hear some interpretations recorded by fans, and dive into some well-known Dylan songs that we know not from Dylan, but from their covers. All of that tomorrow at 9. Join us then, and in the meantime, check us out online at soundcheck.org. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.